You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Scopes Monkey Choir.
Episode 73, continuation of episode 72.
Yes, this is the continuation of our description about the latest issue of Frontiers in Auditory Cognitive Neuroscience. There are 20 articles describing studies and or reviews or opinion pieces. And
we talked about of them last week, and we're going to talk about the other of them this week. Yeah. I am currently in London. If you're in London too, send me an email at scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com, and we'll meet up and have a beer.
And here we go. Let's just dive right back in.
Here we are.
All right, we're going to go with this one here. The title is Musical Expertise and Statistical Learning of Musical and Linguistic Structures.
Oh.
So what the hell is that about? This takes us back to segments, which you mentioned earlier.
Yes, segmenting.
So segmentation. Basically, the idea is with segmentation is that speech is more likely to be perceived as a continuous stream of sounds if you're not familiar with it. So you may be familiar with this. If you hear a language spoken that you really don't know, you have no idea what the language is, or you sometimes can't even figure out where the words begin and end.
Quite often, yeah.
Yeah. So that is that problem. Parsing that out is the segmentation.
Oh.
So it's what infants need to figure out on their own,
which is what I was talking about. With
And it's also what second language learners need to figure out. And so the question is, how does it relate to musical expertise? And they call it statistical learning because that's sort of how they describe the way infants do figure out segmentation. So they actually start to slowly recognize where words begin and end because they start to recognize what kinds of sounds tend to follow other sounds and what kinds of sounds.
Right.
And they slowly start to recognize what sounds go together and they begin to form a mental map of what words are.
Yes.
So one of the interesting things that this paper talks about is that segmentation is better. Recognition of segmentation is better after exposure to sung compared to spoken material.
Huh.
So, for instance, this was a review, so it was looking at a lot of different studies, but so an example of the kind of study that they were reviewing, one, for instance, took a fake language. They made up an artificial language and then played played recordings of that language being spoken for a certain period of time, and then recordings, a separate group, would hear recordings of the same language for the same period of time, the same sounds, except sung instead of just spoken. And they found that people were much more able to figure out where the words begin and end when they're sung to them rather than spoken.
Huh.
Which
even
is really,
though, of course, the languages were totally made up.
Right, exactly, yeah. So, very interesting. And they basically are arguing that musical expertise actually also facilitates the learning of both linguistic and musical structures.
So well, I gotta say, anecdotally, for me, learning new languages, learning songs in other languages helps immensely with all kinds of things about learning a new language, including pronunciation, prosody, segmentation, comprehension. I mean, that's totally anecdotal and actually sort of from the other direction.
Right, yeah. But, and also a little bit tricky because most of your other languages you learned while you were doing your musical training. Right?
Not necessarily. I mean, I remember in high school learning French that one of our French teachers' big things was she would teach us songs, make us listen to songs in French and try to write down the lyrics and then learn them. Anyway, that's so anecdotal, but that feels related.
Right,
personally.
Yeah, right. So segmentation also, I just have to point out that this is my segmentation segue. Because segmentation is also an example of implicit memory, which is what our next paper is about. It's called Implicit Memory in Music and Language. So implicit memory is usually defined as acquired knowledge that is not available to conscious access. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, I guess you could say it in a wooey way. It's like knowing in a different way. No, it's basically knowing, it's knowledge that you acquire sort of automatically without consciously being aware that you're acquiring it. Mm-hmm. So this is in fact what infants are doing when they are learning language. They're just like, they are literally figuring out completely on their own. I mean, they come out of the fucking universe. They're like little babies. They hear sounds and they figure out language by themselves. It's amazing. I'm sorry, but that's so freaking cool. now I'm totally off. So an example of implicit memory in music is often given as non-musicians implicitly knowing the quote rules unquote of the music that they're familiar with. So,
yes.
For instance, if you are familiar with Western music, which you most likely are because you're speaking English and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So non-musicians, especially ones who listen to a lot of music, really know a lot about music, and but they don't have the vocabulary that musicians or people who study music have to describe that knowledge, but they actually do have a lot of knowledge about music. So for instance, if you hear something that sounds wrong in music, that's because you have an implicit memory and implicit knowledge of the rules of how music works, even though you can't describe it, you can't explain.
Right.
Another non-musical example that people often use is riding a bicycle. You learn to ride a bicycle and then you know how to ride a bicycle, but what you really know how to do is how to hold your arms and hold on to the handlebars and move them back and forth in such a way to compensate for their speed and the differing physics of the of whatever your momentum is, and keeping your balance while the balance, you have to maintain balance. Also, depending on your speed, is totally different in those, all these essentially complicated physics. And that's what you implicitly know. And what you describe yourself as knowing is how to ride a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, the paper actually doesn't have much to say. The paper is... That's all.
That's because we all know it implicitly.
Yeah, no, the paper is basically basically goes over the literature of implicit memory in music, and then the literature in implicit memory in language, and points out that there's a lot of similarity in the literature for the two studies, and that someone really should combine them and figure out what's going on, what really are the similarities. Someone should look at it in more than just a review and do some studies that combine the two fields, shall we say.
Well, I have a study by someone who not only combined those two fields in their experiment, but also combined it with the previous review that you were talking about, which is I believe it was that segmenting expertise.
Yeah, the segmentation, yeah.
Yes. Okay, so this is, and also combines with something we were talking about earlier, that is amusia, people who are tone deaf, in big air quotes.
Mm.
This is what it combines from the previous review, a made-up language.
Oh, yes.
So they found 12 amusics who did so badly on tone tests that they were sort of proven to be A musics,
gotcha.
And then 12 controls who were just normal, and they were testing the idea that amusia comes from the inability to form the implicit knowledge of music, possibly related to the inability to absorb the sort of statistical knowledge that you need to understand music implicitly. That is, that you know statistically what probably comes next in a melody or a chord progression, and that basically tells you implicitly the rules of whatever language, whatever musical language you're growing up in.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did is they made up not only languages, but musical scales. They took a 2-octave span and they divided it into 11 steps.
Oh.
So not like any kind of music in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they played everybody a 20-minute series of words in the made-up languages. So sort of like made up sentences. And then they also played them a 20-minute sequence of notes in a made up musical language.
Huh.
And then they tested them a while later by asking them, playing back some sequences and asking them whether they had heard those sequences or not.
Hmm.
So basically testing whether they had absorbed the statistically these two different languages, the music and the language. And basically they found that the A musics had no more trouble. They did almost exactly the same on the tests as the non-A musics. And the only difference that they found was that the A musics rated their confidence level as much lower.
Hmm.
So that they said that they weren't sure about their answers. And I don't know what that implies.
Yeah,
and
actually
the experimenters didn't either, because their hypothesis was that the A musics were going to have trouble absorbing implicitly these new sound languages and musical sounds.
So this is a nice example of that. The Asimov quote? It's a nice example of the scientists coming up with a hypothesis and doing the experiment, and at the end of it, when they get the result, going, "That's funny."
Yeah, that tonal language one where they found that they were less able to distinguish lower pitches.
Yeah,
that's funny. Huh. Uh-huh. On to you, Matthew.
Thank you, Hai Ting. In other news, the transfer of training between music and speech, common processing, attention, and memory. That's actually the name of the next review. I think it's a review. Yeah, it was a review. My brain is exploding. They're basically saying with this, they're arguing that there is lots of evidence for increased sensitivity to pitch, timbre, rhythm, and such when you have musical training. Which is not a big surprise.
Yeah, that's kind of a no duh.
Well, yeah, but you know, but that's why we have science too, because you think something's no duh, and then sometimes you look at it scientifically and you're like, oh,
that's
duh.
Funny.
That's funny, exactly. So there's lots of evidence for that. And but what they wanted, but they're curious about is, does this also mean that musicians would be more sensitive than non-musicians to speech sounds?
All right.
Specifically. So once again, this is a review, and they basically say, well, yeah, from what the literature says so far, the answer seems like it's yes, but it's not definitive. So more research is necessary, which is pretty much how these always end. These
reviews. And that study that I related about the kindergarten age kids, where they were looking to see if musical training helps them with phonetic tasks, is research in that direction, showing that in fact it does.
Right. Now this also relates to another one of the papers was titled Neurophysiological. Sorry. Neurophysiological influence of musical training on speech perception, so clearly related. And they're basically saying, like, all right, there is evidence supporting an influence of musical training on speech perception at the sensory level. I don't know quite what they mean by that, but I mean, what other level is there when you're
there's the processing
senses?
Level.
I see. That's what they mean, of course. So once again, evidence is growing, but still not conclusive. But if that's so, then can speech perception in individuals with hearing loss benefit from musical training?
Ah.
Which is a really interesting idea.
Yeah,
it's
that's
sort of
totally
counterintuitive. This too, they say that the evidence is growing, but it's still not conclusive. But it's a really interesting idea. They're saying that people that are experiencing hearing loss, that one treatment is perhaps to have them learn some music.
Huh.
And that so far the evidence is that might actually be a really good approach.
Wow.
So that's, I hope to hear more about that in years to come. I hope that people listen to these folks and look into that more, because that seems like a really intriguing idea.
Yeah, especially since stem cells are not working for that.
Right.
I got the science or fiction right. We were at the live taping of this week's Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and the one that was fiction, I picked the one that was fiction. I was out there in the audience
clapping for it,
and it was about, it was about the use of stem cells to repair auditory damage, and it was false. Yeah. All right, so I have just a couple more finicky EEG analyses. One of them, they're so hard to describe, actually. One is called EEG Correlates of Song Prosody, a New Look at the Relationship between Linguistic and Musical Rhythm. And basically, they played... they did not at all use music for this. They simply played sentences, and they had metronome ticks either on important syllables or on unimportant syllables.
Mm.
I just tried to do one of those wrong emphasis things and totally failed. I was unable to do it off the cuff. So, surprise, surprise, found that it was easier for subjects to comprehend the sentences when the metronome ticks were on important syllables.
Uh-huh.
And that there were corresponding things in the brain. The brain had it had more response on the important syllables, and that led to lack of confusion.
Uh-huh. Lack of confusion. That's a kink song.
That's a little beyond my pay grade describing that. But they were talking about it with relation to the setting of texts with the important syllables on important beats. And I think that this should be a springboard maybe for you as a songwriter and in a later episode.
Yeah, let's refile this one and maybe come back to it.
And the other final EEG study was called The Influence of Task Irrelevant Music on Language Processing, Syntactic and Semantic Structures. Now, that's not actually as exciting as it sounds. It's not about background
not
music or anything. Basically, what they were doing is they played... This study was done in France, but I'm pretty sure that I read a similar study that was done in Germany last year. I don't know why this is being done in various languages.
Mm.
And it's kind of interesting, but hard to describe. They play people a series of five chords,
right?
And talking about implicit knowledge, with one chord that either just a sort of standard sequence of chords, or one chord that is a deceptive cadence sort of chord,
right?
Which for you musicians,
something
out there,
that
you
sounds
understand.
Wrong,
yeah, something that sounds wrong or unexpected in the sequence,
mm-hmm.
And then they matched up the chords with a series of five words that were a sentence, or there was one word that was a wrong word.
Mm.
And then they looked at people's EEGs when they were listening to this series of five chords and five words at the same time. And then they sort of looked at what happened when the wrong word and the wrong chord were in the same spot at the same time, or when they were in different spots. And they found complicated variations in whether the same parts of the brain were being used to process the wrongness in the language and the music, or whether they were not. And there was a complicated pattern of interference, and I didn't really see that they had any definite conclusions, but they seemed to conclude that there is cross-processing, that the same parts of the brain were being used to say, oh, that one's wrong,
mm-hmm.
in both the music and the language.
Hmm. Interesting. Are you throwing it back to me?
Back to you.
I just wanted to say though that the what is it? The task relevant?
Task irrelevant.
Yeah,
task
when you first said that phrase, task irrelevant music, I was like, okay, clearly what that means is that in the study you have two clubs with people dancing. It's like late at night, everyone's drunk and everyone's dancing. And in one club, you play a song that says, that has the refrain, shake your booty. And in the other club, you have a song that has the refrain, do not shake your booty. Or I guess that would be task negative. Task irrelevant would
task
be like...
Task irrelevant would be like, write a scientific paper.
Right, yes. And then study the effects on the... Yeah.
This would be the lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in another all right, on to anesthesia. That's where we're going now. So the we have another great title here. The effects of music listening on cortisol levels and propofol consumption during spinal anesthesia.
Ah.
Yeah. So this was basically a study. There have been a fair number of these kinds of studies, of a study of playing music before, during, and after surgery to test the effects. Now, I found this, I've come across various other studies like these, and they're usually very small, and they're usually not controlled, and I've never really talked about any because I've always been like, I don't know. And I thought it was interesting that this study claims that it's the first double-blind study of its kind.
And why is it in the music and language?
I have no idea. Weird. That is a very good question. Let me see here. I don't know. Now, what the other thing...
They just stuck it in there. It's a task irrelevant study.
Yeah, maybe, or maybe we just, maybe I actually went to the wrong paper.
Oh, look at
maybe
that.
Maybe I clicked on the wrong link or something, but I'm talking about it now. So I'm not going to stop. Forward, puppies. So
that's first, a task irrelevant word.
I like this study, first of all, because it was double blind. The other thing I like about it is that they used instrumental music only, but they used many different genres, which I also appreciate because, as you know, far too often studies that deal with music, they play Mozart. And then if there's any positive result, then they talk about how Mozart does this and Mozart does that. And I'm so sick of it because it's not, has nothing to do with Mozart. We'll get into that later. So, but in this one, they played some Bach, but they also played some Louis Armstrong. They also played some Jonathan Richman, who is like almost obscure. I adore him, but he's a songwriter. He's awesome, but he's not in the three Bs. Let's put that way. Anyway, so that I like that too. And basically what they found is that at least for one aspect, they tested many parameters, and they only one of them they found a positive correlation, but they did find that listening to music during surgery under regional anesthesia has effects on cortisol levels. Which is, you know, it reflects stress reduction.
In people under anesthesia?
Yeah, under regional anesthesia. Yeah, and then it also reduced the sedative requirements to reach the light sedation. So that is kind of interesting.
I think you must have clicked on the wrong study. I can't imagine how that relates to music and language.
I must have, yeah.
It is fascinating, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we're talking about it, so that's... No, that's not... That doesn't count, does it? No, so they did do that thing where they kind of trumped up they sort of like said yay about our results. But the truth of the matter is that like most of the results showed no effect whatsoever for the various things they think. But they did see this one effect, which maybe is interesting, maybe isn't. It's not for me to decide because I'm just a fucking musician. I just have one more. Do you have any more?
No.
Okay, I have just one more. It's just the one you wanted to hear about.
Yeah.
Which is the effects of practice and experience on the... and here, pronunciation, I need help. On the arcuate fasciculus?
I'm looking at it, but I don't know how to help you.
Fasciculus?
Arcuate fasciculus?
Oh, my God, please.
A prominent white matter tract connecting temporal and frontal brain regions.
Yeah, so please forgive us people who know how to pronounce that. We're not dumb, we're just ignorant. So this was comparing singers, instrumentalists, and non-musicians. And basically what they are arguing that they have found is general differences in both macrostructure and microstructure of the arcuate fasciculus, and not just between musicians and non-musicians, but also between singers and instrumentalists. I should also point out that this is a connective tissue. Right. This is a neural pathway. Right. Mm-hmm. So basically, they're suggesting that perhaps long term vocal training might lead to an increase in volume and complexity of this region, of this pathway. And that they also are arguing that this the pathway is fundamental to sound perception, production, and control.
Uh-huh.
So, so you people with serious singing training in singing. Might have bigger arcuate fasciculus than the rest of us.
I'll show you mine musicians. If you show me yours. puppies.
Phew.
Puppies. I can't believe we just did that. I hope people can wade through that and that there's something interesting in there.
It's all very fascinating. And we just, boy, I
was totally fascinated. I hope you are. I have to get on a plane now.
Yeah, you are going to London.
In fact, by the time you hear this, I will already be in London.
Yeah, and so this is two-parter. This is the end of the second part, which means you're going to be in London, and I'm going to be in London for a week, too, and I don't know when the next episode will be. We will see.
And if you're in London, write to us, and we should have a beer.
Yeah. So until next time, right?
Right. This has been Scopes Monkey Choir.
From ScopesMonkeyChoir.com. We are professional musicians, not scientists. If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself. Nevertheless, each episode's page at ScopesMonkeyChoir.com has references and citations. We love feedback. Write to ScopesMonkeyChoir@gmail.com or call the monkey phone and leave a message. 347-788-0330.
Puppies.
Speaking of feedback, thank you to all of you who wrote in after Nexus, and we got so many nice
emails. Yes, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Y'all are awesome. Until next time.
Bye-bye.